Okay, I said. What we really need is more information. Can you give your mum a call to ask her some more questions? I've never seen the colour so quickly wash away from someone's face. Oh, David, he pleaded. Please, please, please don't make me ask my mother any more questions about that. Since that conversation, which took place in the fall of 2017, I've known a couple of other women and read the accounts of others claiming to have had similar experiences. These cases could, perhaps, be the result of a placebo effect. But a trial in 2018 to test whether an NAD booster could restore the fertility of old horses was successful, surprising the skeptical supervising veterinarian. As far as I know, horses don't experience the placebo effect. Still, these stories and clinical results could be random chance. These matters will be studied in much greater detail. If, however, it turns out that mares and women can become fertile again, it will completely overturn our understanding of reproductive biology. In school, our teachers taught us that women were born with a set number of eggs, perhaps as many as 2 million. Most of the eggs die off before puberty. Almost all the rest are either released during menstruation throughout the course of a woman's life, or just die off along the way until there are no more. And then, we were told, a woman is no longer fertile. Period. These anecdotal reports of restored menstruation and fertile horses are early but interesting indicators that NAD boosters might restore failing or failed ovaries. We also see that NMN is able to restore the fertility of old mice that have had all their eggs killed off by chemotherapy or have gone through menopause. These results, by the way, even though they were done multiple times and reproduced in two different labs by different people, are so controversial that almost no one on the team voted to publish them. I was the exception. They remain unpublished for now. To me, it is clear that we biologists are missing something. Something big. In 2004, Jonathan Tilley, a highly controversial figure in the reproductive biology community, claimed that human stem cells that can give rise to new eggs late in life exist in the ovaries. Controversial though this theory is, it would explain how it's possible to restore fertility even in mice that are old or have undergone chemotherapy. Whether or not egg precursor cells exist in the ovary, there's no doubt in my mind that we are moving with staggering speed toward a world in which women will be able to retain fertility for a much longer portion of their lives and possibly regain it if it's lost. All of this, of course, is good news for people who wish to have a child but haven't been able to for a number of social, economic, or medical reasons. But what does it have to do with aging? To answer that question, we need to remember what an ovary is. It's not just, as so many of us were taught in school, a slow-release mechanism for human eggs. It's an organ, just like our hearts, kidneys, or lungs, that has a day-to-day function, both holding onto eggs that were created during embryonic development and potentially being a repository for additional eggs derived from precursor cells later in life. The ovary is also the first major organ to break down as a result of aging, in humans and animal models alike. What that means in mice is that instead of waiting for 2 years for a mouse to reach old age, we can start to see and investigate the causes and cures for aging in about 12 months, at the age female mice typically lose their ability to reproduce. We also have to remember what NMN does. It boosts NAD, and this boosts the activity of the SIRT2 enzyme, a human form of yeast SIRT2 found in the cytoplasm. SIRT2, we found, controls the process by which an immature egg divides so that only one copy of the mother's chromosomes remain in the final egg in order to make way for the father's chromosomes. Without NMN or additional SIRT2 in old mice, their eggs were toast. Pairs of chromosomes were ripped apart from numerous directions instead of exactly two. But if the old female mice were pre-treated with NMN for a few weeks, their eggs looked pristine, identical to those of young mice. All of this is why early indicators of restored ovarian function in humans, anecdotal as they may be, are so fascinating. If true, the mechanisms that work to prolong, rejuvenate, and reverse aging in ovaries are pathways we can use to do the same thing in other organs. One more thing that's important to bear in mind. NMN is hardly the only longevity molecule showing promise in this area. Metformin is already widely used to improve ovulation in women with infrequent or prolonged menstrual periods as a result of polycystic ovary syndrome. Meanwhile, emerging research is demonstrating that the inhibition of mammalian target of rapamycin, or mTOR, may be able to preserve ovarian function and fertility during chemotherapy, while the same gene pathway plays an important role in male fertility as a central player in the production and development of sperm. Life with father. Most of the time, rodent studies come long before formal human studies. That was the case for NAD boosters. But the early indicators of the safety and effectiveness of the molecules in yeast, worms, and rodents are such that many people have already begun their own private human experiments. My father is among them. Though he trained as a biochemist, my dad's passion was computing. He was a computer guy at a pathology company. That meant he spent a lot of his time sitting in front of a screen and on his behind, another thing experts say is devastatingly bad for our health. Some researchers have even suggested it could be as bad for us as smoking. By the time my mother died in 2014, my father's health had also begun its seemingly inexorable decline. He had retired at 67 and was in his mid-70s, still fairly active. He liked to travel and garden. But he had passed the type 2 diabetes threshold, was losing his hearing, and his eyes were starting to go bad. He would tire fast. He repeated himself. He was grumpy. He was hardly a picture of exuberant life. He started taking metformin for his borderline type 2 diabetes. The next year, he started taking NMN. My father has always been a skeptic, but he is also insatiably curious and was fascinated by what he heard from me about what was happening to the mice in my lab. NMN isn't a regulated substance. It's available as a supplement. So he tried it out, starting with small doses. He knew quite well, though, that there are very big differences between mice and humans. At first, he would say to me and anyone else who asked, "Nothing's changed. How would I know?" So the statement that came about 6 months into his NMN tryout was telling. "I don't want to get carried away," he said, "but something is happening." He was feeling less tired, he told me, less sore, more mentally aware. "I'm outpacing my friends," he said. "They're complaining about feeling old. They can't even come for bushwalks with me anymore. I'm no longer feeling that way. I don't have aches or pains. I'm beating much younger people at rowing exercises at the gym." His doctor, meanwhile, was struck by the fact that his liver enzymes normalized after 20 years of being abnormal. Upon his next visit to the United States, I noticed that something else was different, something very subtle. It dawned on me, for the first time since my mother's death, the smile had returned to his face. These days, he runs around like a teenager, hiking for 6 days through wind and snow to reach the peak of the highest mountain in Tasmania, riding three-wheelers through the Aussie bush, hunting remote waterfalls in the American West, zip-line touring through the forest in northern Germany, whitewater rafting in Montana, ice cave exploring in Austria. He's aging in place, but he's rarely at his place. And because he's missed working, he took on a new career at one of Australia's largest universities, where he sits on the ethics committee that approves human research studies, taking full advantage of his knowledge about scientific rigor, medical practice, and data security. You might expect this sort of behavior from someone who had lived his whole life this way, but he is definitely not a guy who has lived his whole life this way. Dad used to say he wasn't looking forward to getting old. He isn't outgoing or optimistic by nature. He's more like Eeyore from Winnie the Pooh. He expected to have a decent 10 years of retirement, then go into a nursing home. The future was clear. He had seen what had happened to his mother. He had watched helplessly as her health had declined in her 70s and 80s, and as she had suffered from pain and dementia in the final decade of her life. With all of that fresh in mind, the idea of living much past his 70s wasn't very interesting to him. In fact, it was pretty scary. But he's pretty happy with how it's turning out, and wakes up every morning with a deep-seated desire to fill his life with new, exciting experiences. To that end, he faithfully takes his metformin and his NMN each morning and gets nervous when they start to run low. The turnaround in his energy, enjoyment of life, and perspective on growing old has been remarkable. It could be all unrelated to the molecules he's taking. I suppose his physical and mental transformation may be just how some people age, but it sure wasn't that way for any of my other relatives. My father is also wondering what to think. We are a family of scientists, after all. I can't be sure that the NMN is responsible, he told me recently. He thought about his life for a moment, then smiled and shrugged his shoulders. But there's really no other explanation. Recently, after touring much of the east coast of the United States, Dad was heading home to Australia. I sheepishly asked him if he could fly back to the United States for an event being held the following month. I had been named an Officer of the Order of Australia, an honor bestowed for distinguished service to medical research into the biology of aging, to biosecurity initiatives, and as an advocate for the study of science. And there was going to be a ceremony at the Australian Embassy in Washington, D.C. Sandra says it's not fair for me to ask you to come back, I told him. It's only 4 weeks from now, and you're almost 80, and it's a long journey back, and... I would love to come, he said, but I'm just not sure I can fit it into my schedule. He cancelled some meetings and did fit the trip into his schedule, and having him there, along with Sandra and the kids, ensured that it was one of the best days of my life. As I looked at Dad standing with my family, I thought, this is what longer life is all about, having your parents there for life's important moments. And as he stood there, he later told me, he thought, this is what longer life is all about, being around for your children's important moments. My father's story of reinvigoration is, of course, completely anecdotal. I won't be publishing it in a scientific journal anytime soon. A placebo can be a powerful drug after all. There's simply no way to know if the combo of NMN and metformin is the reason he's feeling better, or is simply what he started taking at the time he decided subconsciously that it was time for a big change in his approach to life. Compelling evidence that the clock of aging is reversible will come when well-planned, double-blind, human clinical studies are completed. Until then, I remain very proud of my father, an average guy who grabbed life by the horns in his late 70s to start his life anew, a shining example of what life can be like if we don't accept aging as just the way it goes. Still, it's hard for me and anyone else who has seen what happened to my father to not suspect that something special might be going on. It's also hard to know what I know, to see what I've seen, the results of experiments and other clinical trials around the world, years before the rest of the world learns about them, and not believe that something profound is about to happen to humanity. Come what may. By engaging our body's survival mechanisms in the absence of real adversity, will we push our lifespans far beyond what we can today? And what will be the best way to do this? Could it be a souped-up AMPK activator, a TOR inhibitor, a STAC or NAD booster, or a combination of them with intermittent fasting and high-intensity interval training? The potential permutations are virtually endless. Maybe the research underway on any one of these molecular approaches to battling aging will provide half a decade of additional good health. Maybe a combination of these compounds and an optimal lifestyle will be the elixir that gets us a couple of extra decades. Or maybe, as time goes by, our enthusiasm for these molecules will be dwarfed by what we discover next. The discovery of the molecules I have described here can be credited to a lot of serendipity. But imagine what the world will discover now that we're actively and intentionally looking for molecules that engage our inbuilt defenses. Armies of chemists are now working to create and analyze natural and synthetic molecules that have the potential to be even better at suppressing epigenomic noise and resetting our epigenetic landscape. There are hundreds of compounds that have already shown potential in this area, and hundreds of thousands more that are waiting to be researched. And it's very possible that there is an as-yet undiscovered chemical out there, hiding in a microorganism such as S. hygroscopicus, or in a flower such as G. officinalis, that is just waiting to show us another way to help our bodies stay healthier longer. And that's just the natural chemicals, which are typically many times less effective than the synthetic drugs they inspire. Indeed, the emerging analogs of the molecules I've already described are demonstrating tremendous potential in early-stage human clinical trials. It will take some time to sort out which of these molecules are best, when and for whom, but we're getting closer every day. There will come a time in which significantly prolonged vitality is indeed only a few pills away. There are too many promising leads, too many talented researchers, and too much momentum for it to be otherwise. Will any of these be a cure for aging? No. What's likely is that researchers will continue to identify molecules that are better and better at promoting both a reduction of epigenetic noise and a rejuvenation of cellular tissue. As we do, we'll be buying time for other advances that will also lead to significantly prolonged vitality. But let's say that doesn't happen. For the sake of argument, not to mention emphasis, let's pretend we live in a world in which none of these molecules had ever been discovered and no one had ever thought to address aging with a pharmaceutical. That would not change the inevitability of longer and healthier lives. Not at all. For drugs that engage the ancient survival mechanisms within us are just one of the many ways that scientists, engineers, and entrepreneurs are setting the stage for the most significant shift in the evolution of our species since, well, since forever.
Okay, let's talk about molecules.
That's cool, because this for me was such a fascinating area to learn about. Because, well, when I was first introduced to your work, the thing I thought was, well, if this NAD pathway thing that David's working on doesn't end up working, then, well, I guess we're not all going to live longer and healthier lives. But then I learned about these other molecules. You told me about these other molecules. And that's when, for me, one of the major themes of the book really materialized, that maybe one of these areas of research will fail to offer the promise of longer lifespans and health spans, but the likelihood of failure across the board seems, well, to me, it seems really low.
Exactly. This is what I wanted to get across in our book, is that even if I get hit by a bus tomorrow, hopefully that won't happen. There are so many people working on this, and there's been such a change in academia with professors realizing this is an area that should be studied and increasing investment by governments and industry, that this is an inevitability, that it's going to happen. And whether one molecule fails, it doesn't matter, because there's a dozen more that are going through, many of them already in human clinical trials. And that's the other thing a lot of people are surprised to hear, that we're not just working on yeast and worms and mice. There are actual human studies looking at slowing down the pace of aging right now.
Now, you mentioned yeast and worms and mice, and I think it's maybe important to make this observation that, you know, when something happens in just one model organism, right, we can kind of shrug our shoulders and we can say, well, that's one model organism. That's the whole, like, in mice movement, right? When you read a scientific study and you say the words in mice to remind people that we're not talking about human beings. But when you see something happen in yeast and you see something happen in roundworms and you see something happen in mice, the likelihood increases with each model organism that we're going to see it in other model organisms and in human beings too, correct?
Exactly. Now, we're talking about understanding fundamental mechanisms of biology. This isn't Alzheimer's disease where essentially humans get it. We're talking about a process that has been on Earth in life since we first came out of the scum-filled ponds. And so if we can crack that one, the same drug that works on little fungi like yeast could possibly work on us, because it's not specific to us. That's the main point.
One of the things I found really interesting in this last chapter is that a lot of people are now taking some of the molecules that we mention. A lot of people are taking NAD boosters of one kind or another. Millions of people have been taking metformin for decades. But pretty much nobody is taking rapamycin because of the toxicity in longer-lived species like us, like humans. But there are still quite a few companies working on rapalogs, which might have a similar effect on lifespan and health span, but without the toxicity. What are you seeing in that side of the research right now?
Yeah, So rapamycin is the most powerful molecule in terms of its ability to extend lifespan of animals, at least. And it has shown some promise in some small human studies to boost the immune system of the elderly. But like you say, it's toxic. It actually can hurt the kidneys and can also and does suppress the immune system. But there have been some breakthroughs in making molecules that don't have the side effects. And in fact, Dudley Lamming, who's a professor at the University of Michigan, is actually just had a recent publication that showed that he could selectively inhibit the rapamycin pathway called mTOR and not have the side effects in mice. But it's exciting because it means that we might have the huge benefits of rapamycin without the side effects. And that would truly be the kind of molecule that we're hoping to see on available to patients to be able to treat not just one disease at a time, but all major diseases at the same time with a single pill.
Now, that guy used to work in your lab, right?
Yeah, Dudley was a student. We worked on yeast and we found that the sirtuins extended lifespan. And he found that there's a bunch of sirtuins. In the book, I focus on the SIR2 enzyme, SIR2. But there are actually others. There are three others, actually four others, that can extend lifespan in yeast besides the SIR2. And that's what he did.
How cool is it for you as a professor, as a mentor, to see people going out and running their own labs and having their own discoveries?
That's one of the best things about this career. I always thought that making the discoveries would be the best part. But the joy of discovering something is very short-lived. You feel good for about a day or two, and then you have to worry about getting the next grant or who's going to criticize you or is it really true. But what really has been rewarding in this career, and for any kids or young people who are thinking about careers, become a scientist not for the discoveries but for the feeling you get when you train people. There's nothing better than seeing either your kids or your trainees succeed. And also the friends you make along the way. My scientific colleagues, we've been through wars together. And it's that part that is actually the most rewarding part of this very difficult career that we have as scientists.
6. Big steps ahead. To the extent we thought about it, and we seldom did, we used to think aging would be a very complicated thing to change, if we could change it at all. For most of human history, of course, we simply saw aging like the coming of the seasons. Indeed, the shift from spring to summer to fall to winter was a common analogy we used to describe the movement from childhood to young adulthood to middle age to our golden years. More recently, we figured that aging was inexorable, but we might be able to deal with some of the diseases that made it a less appealing process. Later still, we figured that we might be able to attack each of the hallmarks and perhaps we could treat a few of the symptoms at a time. Even then, it seemed as though it would be a huge endeavor. But here's the thing. It's really not. Once you recognize that there are universal regulators of aging in everything from yeast to roundworms to mice to humans, and once you understand that those regulators can be changed with a molecule such as NMN, or a few hours of vigorous exercise, or a few less meals, and once you realize that it's all just one disease, it all becomes clear. Aging is going to be remarkably easy to tackle. Easier than cancer. I know how that sounds. It sounds crazy. But so did the idea of microorganisms before an amateur scientist named Antony van Leeuwenhoek first described the world of these small little animals he saw under his homemade microscope in 1671. For hundreds of years to come, doctors rebelled against the idea that they needed to wash their hands before surgery. Now infections, one of the chief reasons patients used to die after surgery, have become the very thing that hospital personnel are most fastidiously attentive to preventing in the operating room. Just by washing up before surgery, we have profoundly improved the rates at which patients survive. Once we understood what the problem was, it was an easy problem to solve. For goodness sake, we solved it with soap. The idea of vaccines would also have sounded crazy to most people before the English physician Edward Jenner successfully used fluid he had gathered from a cowpox blister to inoculate an 8-year-old boy named James Phipps in what today would be an egregiously unethical experiment, but at the time sparked a new era in immunological medicine. Indeed, the idea of giving a patient a little bit of a disease in order to prevent a lot of disease would have been seen as insane, even potentially homicidal to many people, until Jenner did it in 1796. We now know that vaccines are the single most effective medical intervention in human history in terms of saving and extending lifespans. So again, once we understood what the problem was, it was an easy one to solve. The successes of STAX, AMPK activators, and mTOR inhibitors are a tremendously powerful indicator that we are working in an area of our biology that is upstream of every major aging-associated disease. The fact that these molecules have been shown to extend the lifespan of virtually every organism they've been tested on is further evidence that we're engaging with an ancient and powerful program to prolong life. But there is another pharmaceutical target that could increase our longevity just a bit downstream from the processes we believe longevity molecules are impacting, but still upstream of a lot of the symptoms of aging. You might recall that one of the key hallmarks of aging is the accumulation of senescent cells. These are cells that have permanently ceased reproduction. Young human cells taken out of the body and grown in a petri dish divide about 40 to 60 times until their telomeres become critically short, a point discovered by the anatomist Leonard Hayflick that we now call the Hayflick limit. Although the enzyme known as telomerase can extend telomeres, the discovery of which afforded Elizabeth Blackburn, Carol Greider, and Jack Shostak a Nobel Prize in 2009, it is switched off to protect us from cancer, except in stem cells. In 1997, it was a remarkable finding that if you put telomerase into cultured skin cells, they don't ever senesce. Why short telomeres cause senescence has been mostly worked out. A very short telomere will lose its histone packaging, and, like a shoelace that's lost an aglet, the DNA at the end of the chromosome becomes exposed. The cell detects the DNA end and thinks it's a DNA break. It goes to work to try to repair the DNA end, sometimes fusing two ends of different chromosomes together, which leads to hypergenome instability, as chromosomes are shredding during cell division and fused again, over and over, potentially becoming a cancer. The other safer solution to a short telomere is to shut the cell down. This happens, I believe, by permanently engaging the survival circuit. The exposed telomere, seen as a DNA break, causes epigenetic factors such as the sirtuins to leave their posts permanently in an attempt to repair the damage, but there is no other DNA end to ligate it to. This shuts cell replication down, similar to the way that broken DNA in old yeast distracts sirtu from the mating genes and shuts down fertility. Triggering of the DNA damage response and major alterations to the epigenome are well known to occur in human senescent cells. And when we introduce epigenetic noise into the ice cells, they go on to senesce earlier than untreated cells. So maybe this idea has merit. I suspect that senescence in nerve and muscle cells, which don't divide much or at all, is the result of epigenetic noise that causes cells to lose their identity and shut down. This once beneficial response, which evolved to help cells survive DNA damage, has a dark side. The permanently panicked cell sends out signals to surrounding cells, causing them to panic too. Senescent cells are often referred to as zombie cells, because even though they should be dead, they refuse to die. In the petri dish, and in frozen, thinly sliced tissue sections, we can stain zombie cells blue because they make a rare enzyme called beta-galactosidase. And when we do that, they light up clearly. The older the cells, the more blue we see. For example, a sample of white fat looks white when we are in our 20s, pale blue in middle age, and dark royal blue in old age. And that's scary because when we have lots of these senescent cells in our bodies, it's a clear sign that aging is getting a strong grip on us. Small numbers of senescent cells can cause widespread havoc. Even though they stop dividing, they continue to release tiny proteins called cytokines that cause inflammation and attract immune cells called macrophages that then attack the tissue. Being chronically inflamed is unhealthy. Just ask someone with multiple sclerosis, inflammatory bowel disease, or psoriasis. All these diseases are associated with excess cytokine proteins. Inflammation is also a driving force in heart disease, diabetes, and dementia. It is so central to the development of age-related diseases that scientists often refer to the process as inflammaging. And cytokines don't just cause inflammation. They also cause other cells to become zombies, like a biological apocalypse. When this happens, they can even stimulate surrounding cells to become a tumor and spread. We already know that destroying senescent cells in mice can give them substantially healthier and significantly longer lives. It keeps their kidneys functioning better for longer. It makes their hearts more resistant to stress. Their lifespans, as a result, are 20 to 30% longer, according to research led by Mayo Clinic molecular biologists Darren Baker and Jan van Dersen. In animal models of disease, killing of senescent cells makes fibrotic lungs more pliable, slows the progression of glaucoma and osteoarthritis, and reduces the size of all sorts of tumors. Understanding why senescence evolved is not just an academic exercise. It could help us design better ways to prevent or kill senescent cells. Cellular senescence is a consequence of our inherited primordial survival circuits, which evolved to stop cell division and reproduction when DNA breaks were detected. Just as in old yeast cells, if DNA breaks happen too frequently or they overwhelm the circuit, human cells will stop dividing, then sit there in a panic, trying to repair the damage, messing up their epigenome and secreting cytokines. This is the final stage of cellular aging, and it's not pretty. If zombie cells are so bad for our health, why doesn't our body just kill them off? Why are senescent cells allowed to cause trouble for decades? Back in the 1950s, the evolutionary biologist George Williams was already on the case. His work, built upon by Judith Campisi from the Buck Institute for Research on Aging in California, proposes that we evolved senescence as a rather clever trick to prevent cancer when we are in our 30s and 40s. Senescent cells, after all, don't divide, which means that cells with mutations aren't able to spread and form tumors. But if senescence evolved to prevent cancer, why would it eventually promote cancer in adjacent tissue, not to mention a host of other aging-related symptoms? This is where antagonistic pleiotropy comes into play. The idea that a survival mechanism that is good for us when we are young is kept through evolution because this far outweighs any problems it might cause when we get older. Yes, natural selection is callous, but it works. Consider the 15 million year history of hominids, the great apes. In the vast majority of our family's evolutionary journey, the forces of predation, starvation, disease, maternal mortality, infection, catastrophic weather events, and intraspecies violence meant that very few individuals saw more than a decade or two of life. Even in the relatively recent era of the Homo genus, what we now think of as middle age is an exceptionally new phenomenon. A life expectancy of 50 and beyond was simply not a reality for most of our evolutionary history. Therefore, it didn't matter if a mechanism for slowing the spread of cancer would eventually cause more cancer and other diseases, because it generally worked, as long as it allowed people to breed and rear some children. The saber-toothed tigers took things from there. These days, of course, few people have to worry about being picked off by hungry predators. Hunger and malnutrition are still far too common, but abject starvation is increasingly rare. We're getting better and better at staving off childhood diseases and have eliminated some of them almost entirely. Childbirth is an increasingly safe affair, although that too is something that can be vastly improved upon, especially in the developing world. Modern sanitation has resulted in tremendous improvements in the rates at which we die of infectious diseases. Modern technology is helping to warn us of impending catastrophes such as hurricanes and volcanic eruptions. And although the world often seems to be a vicious and violent place, the worldwide homicide rate and the numbers of wars globally have been falling for decades. So we live longer, and evolution hasn't had a chance to catch up. We're plagued by senescent cells, which might as well be radioactive waste. If you put a tiny dab of these cells under a young mouse's skin, it won't be long before inflammation spreads and the entire mouse is filled with zombie cells that cause premature signs of aging. A class of pharmaceuticals called senolytics may be the zombie killers we need to fight the battle against aging on this front. These small molecule drugs are designed to specifically kill senescent cells by inducing the death program that should have happened in the first place. That's what the Mayo Clinic's James Kirkland has done. He needed only a quick course of two senolytic molecules, quercetin, which is found in capers, kale, and red onions, and a drug called dasatinib, which is a standard chemotherapy treatment for leukemia, to eliminate the senescent cells in lab mice and extend their lifespan by 36%. The implications of this work cannot be overstated. If senolytics work, you could take a course of a medicine for a week, be rejuvenated, and come back 10 years later for another course. Meanwhile, the same medicines could be injected into an osteoarthritic joint or an eye going blind, or inhaled into lungs made fibrotic and inflexible by chemotherapy to give them an age reversal boost too. Rapamycin, the Easter Island longevity molecule, is what's known as a senomorphic molecule, in that it doesn't kill senescent cells, but does prevent them from releasing inflammatory molecules, which may be almost as good. See page 11 in the PDF. The first human trials of senolytics were started in 2018 to treat osteoarthritis and glaucoma, conditions in which senescent cells can accumulate. It will be a few more years before you know enough about the effects and safety of these drugs to provide them to everyone. But if they work, the potential is vast. But there's another option, just a bit further upstream, that could be even better. The Hitchhiker's Guide. The selfish genes we discussed earlier, called line 1 retrotransposons, and their fossil remnants, make up about half of the human genome, what is often referred to as junk DNA. It's a lot of genetic baggage, and they are sneaky buggers. In young cells, these ancient mobile DNA elements, also known as retrotransposons, are prevented by chromatin from jumping out of the genome, then breaking DNA to reinsert themselves elsewhere. We and others have shown that line 1 genes are bundled up and rendered silent by sirtuins. But as mice age, and possibly as we do as well, these sirtuins become scattered all over the genome, having been recruited away to repair DNA breaks elsewhere, and many of them never find their way home. This loss is exacerbated by a drop in NAD levels, the same thing we first saw in old yeast. Without sirtuins to spool the chromatin and silence the transposon DNA, cells start to transcribe these endogenous viruses. This is bad, and it only gets worse. Over time, as mice age, the once silent line 1 prisoners are turned into RNA, and the RNA is turned into DNA, which is reinserted into the genome at a different place. Besides creating genome instability and epigenomic noise that causes inflammation, line 1 DNA leaks from the nucleus into the cytoplasm, where it is recognized as a foreign invader. In response, the cells release even more immunostimulatory cytokines that cause inflammation throughout the body. New work by John Sedavy at Brown University and Vera Gorbanova from the University of Rochester raises the possibility that one of the main reasons SIRT6 mutant mice age so rapidly is that these retroviral hellhounds have no leash, causing numerous DNA breaks and the epigenome to degrade rapidly instead of slowly. Convincing evidence has come from experiments showing that antiretrovirals, the same kinds used to fight HIV, extend the lifespan of SIRT6 mutant mice about twofold. It may turn out that as NAD levels decline with age, sirtuins are rendered unable to silence retrotransposon DNA. Perhaps one day, safe antiretroviral drugs or NAD boosters will be used to keep these jumping genes silent. We would not have stopped aging completely at its source, but we would be fighting the battle before total anarchy ensues, and the genie that is aging becomes even harder to put back in the bottle. Vax to the Future. In 2018, scientists at Stanford University reported that they had developed an inoculation that significantly lowered the rates at which mice suffered from breast, lung, and skin cancer. By injecting the mice with stem cells inactivated by radiation and later adding a booster shot like those humans use for tetanus, hepatitis B, and whooping cough, the stem cells primed the immune system to attack cancers that normally would be invisible to the immune system. Other immuno-oncological approaches are making even greater strides. Therapies such as PD-1 and PD-L1 inhibitors, which expose cancer cells so they can be killed, and chimeric antigen receptors T-cell therapies, or CAR-T, which modify the patient's own immune T-cells and re-inject them to go kill cancer cells, are saving lives of people who, just a few years before, have been told to go home and make funeral arrangements. Now, some of these patients are being given a new lease on life. If we can use the immune system to kill cancer cells, it stands to reason that we can do that for senescent cells too. And some scientists are on the case. Judith Campisi from the Buck Institute for Research on Aging and Manuel Serrano from Barcelona University believe that senescent cells, like cancers, remain invisible to the immune system by waving little protein signs that say, "No zombie cells here." If Campisi and Serrano are right, we should be able to take away those signs and give the immune system permission to go kill senescent cells. Perhaps a few decades from now, a typical vaccine schedule that currently protects babies against polio, measles, mumps, and rubella might also include a shot to prevent senescence when they reach middle age. When people first hear that it may be possible to vaccinate against aging, rather than just treat its symptoms or slow it down, it's not uncommon for them to immediately express worries that we are playing God or interfering with Mother Nature. Maybe we are, but if so, that's not unique to people involved in the fight against aging. We fight diseases of all kinds that God or Mother Nature gave us. We've been doing so for a long time, and we're going to keep doing so for a long time to come. The world rightfully celebrated the eradication of smallpox in 1980. When malaria is likewise eradicated, and I believe it will be sometime in the coming decades, our global community will rejoice once again. And if I could offer the world a vaccine for HIV right now, there wouldn't be many people, no decent ones at least, who would say that we should just let nature run its course. These are ailments we've long considered diseases, though, and I accept that it will take some time to convince people that aging is no different. To this end, I found this thought experiment to be helpful. Imagine an Airbus A380, a double-decker super jumbo filled with 600 people on board, on approach to Los Angeles. The plane does not have landing gear, only parachutes, and all but one of the doors is stuck. So when the passengers evacuate, one by one, they'll be scattered across the most densely populated area of the country. Oh, and one more thing. The passengers are sick. Really sick. The disease they carry is highly contagious. It starts with lethargy and sore joints, then develops into hearing and vision loss, bones as brittle as century-old teacups, excruciatingly painful heart failure, and brain signals so badly interrupted that many victims won't even be able to remember who they are. No one survives this disease, and death is almost always agonizing. After a life of faithful service to the United States, you have found yourself behind the resolute desk in the Oval Office of the White House. The phone rings. The Deputy Director for Infectious Diseases from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention tells you that if even one of the passengers is permitted to parachute into the greater Los Angeles area, tens of thousands of people will catch the disease and die. Each additional parachuter will increase the projected death toll exponentially. The moment you put the receiver down, the phone rings again. The chairperson of the Joint Chiefs of Staff tells you that six U.S. Air Force F-22 Raptor fighters are tracking the plane as it circles over the Pacific Ocean. The pilots have it locked in. Their missiles are ready. The plane is running out of gas. The fate of the passengers and the entire United States rests upon your orders. What do you do? This, of course, is a trolley problem, an ethical thought experiment of the type popularized by the philosopher Philippa Foot that pits our moral duty not to inflict harm on others against our social responsibility to save a greater number of lives. It's also, however, a handy metaphor, because the highly contagious disease the passengers are carrying is, as you doubtless have noticed, nothing more than a faster-acting version of aging. When presented with the idea of a disease that could infect and kill legions of people, with horrendous symptoms no less, very few of us would not make the horrible but necessary call to shoot down the plane, taking the lives of hundreds of people to protect the lives of millions. With that in mind, consider this question. If you would sacrifice hundreds of human lives to stop a fast-acting version of aging from infecting millions, what would you be willing to do to prevent the disease as it actually occurs in the lives of everyone on the planet? Worry not. What I'm about to suggest won't actually come at the cost of human lives. Not hundreds, not dozens, not even one. But it would require us to confront an idea that many people would find alarming. Infecting ourselves with a virus that would quickly move into every cell in our body, turning us into genetically modified organisms. The virus wouldn't kill, it would do the opposite. Get with the reprogram. Vaccines against senescent cells, CR mimetics, and retrotransposon suppressors are possible pathways to prolonged vitality, and work is underway already in labs and clinics around the world. But what if we didn't need any of that? What if we could reset the aging clock and prevent cells from ever losing their identity and becoming senescent in the first place? Yes, the solution to aging could be cellular reprogramming, a resetting of the landscape, the way, for instance, that jellyfish have been shown to do by using small body fragments to regenerate polyps that spawn a dozen new jellies. The DNA blueprint to be young, after all, is always there, even when we are old. So how can we make the cell reread the blueprint? Here it's helpful to return to the DVD metaphor. Over time, thanks to use and perhaps misuse, the digital information encoded as pits in the top layer of aluminum becomes obscured by some deep and some fine scratches, making it hard for the DVD player to read the disc. A DVD has 30 miles of data spiraled around the disc from the edge to the center. So if the disc is scratched, finding the start of a particular song becomes extremely difficult. It's the same situation for old cells, but far worse. The DNA in our cells holds about the same amount of data as a DVD, but in 6 feet of DNA that's packed into a cell a tenth the size of a speck of dust. Together, all the DNA in our body, if laid end to end, would stretch twice the diameter of the solar system. Unlike a simple DVD, though, the DNA in our cells is wet and vibrating in three dimensions. And there aren't 50 songs, there are more than 20,000. No wonder gene reading becomes difficult the older we get. It's miraculous that any cell finds the right genes in the first place. See page 12 in the PDF. There are two ways to play an old, scratched DVD with fidelity. You could buy a better DVD player, one with a more powerful laser that could reveal the data under the scratches. Or you could polish the disc to expose the information again, making the DVD as good as new. I've heard that a rag with toothpaste on it works just fine. Restoring youth in an organism is never going to be as simple as polishing a disc with toothpaste, but the first approach, putting a scratched DVD into a new player, was. Oxford University professor John Gurdon first did this in 1958 when he removed the chromosomes from a frog's egg and replaced them with some chromosomes from an adult frog, and obtained living tadpoles. Then, in 1996, Ian Wilmot and his colleagues at the University of Edinburgh replaced the chromosomes of a sheep's egg with those from an udder cell. The result was Dolly, whose birth was met with a heated public debate about the purported dangers of cloning. The debate overshadowed the most important point, that old DNA retains the information needed to be young again. That debate has since died down. The world today has other concerns. Cloning is now routinely done to produce farm animals, racehorses, and even pets. In 2017, you could order up a dog clone for the bargain price of $40,000, or two of them, as Barbara Streisand did, to replace her beloved Sammy, a curly-haired coton de Tulier. The fact that Sammy was 14 when she died and donated cells, that's somewhere in the range of 75 in dog years, didn't impact the clones one bit. The implications of these experiments are profound. What they show is that aging can be reset. The scratches on the DVD can be removed and the original information can be recovered. Epigenomic noise is not a one-way street. But how might we reset the body without becoming a clone? In his 1948 publications about the preservation of information during data transmissions, Claude Shannon provided a valuable clue. In an abstract sense, he proposed that information loss is simply an increase in entropy or the uncertainty of resolving a message, and provided brilliant equations to back his ideas up. His work stemmed from the mathematics of Harry Nyquist and Ralph Hartley, two other engineers at Bell Labs, who, in the 1920s, revolutionized our understanding of information transmission. Their notions of an ideal code were important for Shannon's development of his communication theory. In the 1940s, Shannon became obsessed with communications over a noisy channel in which information is simply a set of possible messages that needs to be reconstructed by the recipient of the message, the receiver. As Shannon brilliantly showed in his noisy channel coding theorem, it is possible to communicate information nearly error-free as long as you don't exceed the channel capacity. But if the data exceeds the channel capacity or is subject to noise, which is often the case with analog data, the best way to ensure it makes it to the receiver is to store a backup set of data. That way, even if some primary data are lost, an observer can send this correcting data to a correcting device to recover the original message. This is how the internet works. If data packets are lost, they are recovered and resent moments later, all thanks to Transmission Control Protocol, Internet Protocol, or TCP/IP. See page 13 in the PDF. As Shannon puts it, this observer notes the errors in the recovered message and transmits data to the receiving point over a correction channel to enable the receiver to correct the errors. Though it may sound like esoteric language from the 1940s, what dawned on me in 2014 is that Shannon's A Mathematical Theory of Communication is relevant to the information theory of aging. In Shannon's drawing, there are three different components that have analogs in biology. One, the source of the information is the egg and the sperm from your parents. Two, the transmitter is the epigenome, transmitting analog information through space and time. Three, the receiver is your body in the future. When an egg is fertilized, epigenetic information, biological radio signals, is sent out. It travels between dividing cells across time. If all goes well, the egg develops into a healthy baby and eventually a healthy teenager. But with successive cell divisions and the overreaction of the survival circuit to DNA damage, the signal becomes increasingly noisy. Eventually, the receiver, your body when it is 80, has lost a lot of the original information. We know that cloning a new tadpole or a mammal from an old one is possible. So even if a lot of the epigenetic information is lost in old age, obscured by epigenetic noise, there must be information that tells the cell how to reset. This fundamental information, laid down early in life, is able to tell the body how to be young again, the equivalent of a backup of the original data. To end aging as we know it, we need to find three more things that Shannon knew were essential for a signal to be restored, even if it is obscured by noise. One, an observer who records the original data. Two, the original correction data. And three, a correcting device to restore the original signal. I believe we may have finally found the biological correcting device. In 2006, the Japanese stem cell researcher Shinya Yamanaka announced to the world that after testing dozens of combinations of genes, he had discovered that a set of four, OCT4, KLF4, SOX2, and c-MYC, could induce adult cells to become pluripotent stem cells, or iPSCs, which are immature cells that can be coaxed into becoming any other cell type. These four genes code for powerful transcription factors that each controls entire sets of other genes that move cells around on the Waddington landscape during embryonic development. These genes are found in most multicellular species, including chimpanzees, monkeys, dogs, cows, mice, rats, chickens, fish, and frogs. For his discovery, essentially showing that complete cellular age reversal was possible in a petri dish, Yamanaka won the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine, along with John Gurdon in 2012. We now call these four genes Yamanaka factors. At first blush, Yamanaka's experiments might sound like a nifty laboratory parlor trick, but the implications for aging are profound, and not only because he paved the way for us to grow entirely new populations of blood cells, tissues, and organs in the dish that can be and are being transplanted into patients. What he identified, I believe, is the reset switch responsible for Gurdon's tadpoles, the biological correcting device. I predict, and my students are now showing in the lab, that we can use these and other switches not just to reset our cells in petri dishes, but to reset an entire body's epigenetic landscape, to get the marbles back into the valleys where they belong, sending sirtuins back to where they came from, for instance. Cells that have lost their identity during aging can be led back to their true selves. This is the DVD polish we've been looking for. We are making progress every week in restoring the youthful epigenome of mice by delivering reprogramming factors. The pace of discovery is mind-spinning. A full night of sleep for me and my lab members is increasingly rare. In the 1990s, there were major concerns about the safety of delivering genes to humans. But there are a rapidly increasing number of approved gene therapy products and hundreds of clinical trials underway. Patients with an RPE65 mutation that causes blindness, for example, can now be cured with a simple injection of a safe virus that infects the retina and delivers forever the functional RPE65 gene. I predict that cellular reprogramming in the body will first be used to treat age-related diseases in the eye, such as glaucoma and macular degeneration. The eye is the organ of choice to trial gene therapies because it is immunologically isolated. But if the therapy is safe enough to deliver into the entire body, as the long-term mouse studies in my lab suggest they might one day be, this may be in our future. At age 30, you would get a week's course of 3 injections that introduce a specially engineered adeno-associated virus, or AAV, which causes a very mild immune response, less even than what is commonly caused by a flu shot. The virus, which has been known to scientists since the 1960s, has been modified so it doesn't spread or cause illness. What this theoretical version of the virus would carry would be a small number of genes, some combination of Yamanaka factors perhaps, and a fail-safe switch that could be turned on with a well-tolerated molecule such as doxycycline, an antibiotic that can be taken as a tablet, or, even better, one that's completely inert. Nothing, at that point, would change in the way your genes work. But when you begin to see and feel the effects of aging, likely sometime in your mid-40s, you would be prescribed a month's course of doxycycline. With that, the reprogramming genes would be switched on. During the process, you'd likely place a drop of blood in a home biotracker, or pay a visit to the doctor to make sure the system was working as expected, but that's about it. Over the next month, your body would undergo a rejuvenation process as Waddington's marbles were sent back to where they once were when you were young. Gray hair would disappear, wounds would heal faster, wrinkles would fade, organs would regenerate, you would think faster, hear higher-pitched sounds, and no longer need glasses to read a menu. Your body would feel young again. Like Benjamin Button, you would feel 35 again, then 30, then 25. But unlike Benjamin Button, that's where you'd stop. The prescription would be discontinued. The AAV would switch off. the Yamanaka factors would fall silent. Biologically, physically, and mentally, you would be a couple of decades younger, but you'd retain all your knowledge, wisdom, and memories. You would be young again, not just looking young, but actually young, free to spend the next few decades of your life without the aches and pains of middle age, untroubled by the prospects of cancer and heart disease. Then a few more decades down the road, when those gray hairs begin to show up again, you'd start another cycle of the prescribed trigger. What's more, with the pace at which biotech is advancing, and as we learn how to manipulate the factors that reset our cells, we may be able to move away from using viruses and simply take a month's course of pills. Does that sound like science fiction? Something that is very far out in the future? Let me be clear, it's not. Manuel Serrano, the leader of the Cellular Plasticity and Disease Laboratory at the Institute for Research in Biomedicine in Barcelona, and Juan Carlos Belmonte at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies in San Diego, have already engineered mice that have all the Yamanaka factors from birth. These can be turned on by injecting the mice with doxycycline. In a now famous study from 2016, when Belmonte triggered the Yamanaka factors for just 2 days a week throughout the lifespan of a prematurely aging mouse breed called LMNA, the mice remained young compared to their untreated siblings and lived 40% longer. He's shown that the skin and kidneys of regular old mice heal more quickly too. The Yamanaka treatment, however, was highly toxic. If Belmonte overdid it by giving the mice the antibiotic for a few more days, the mice died. Serrano had also shown that by pushing the marbles too far up the landscape, the four-gene combo could induce teratomas, which are particularly disgusting tumors made up of several types of tissue, such as hair, muscle, or bone. Clearly, this tech is not ready for prime time, at least not yet. But we're getting closer every day to being able to control the Waddington marbles safely, making sure they land back precisely in their original valleys and not at the top of the mountain where they could cause cancer. While all this was going on, guided by the success of the ice mouse experiments, my lab had been looking for ways to delay and reverse epigenetic aging. We'd tried many different approaches. The Notch gene, WNT, the four Yamanaka factors. Some had worked a little, but most were turning into tumor cells. One day in 2016, after failing consistently for 2 years to get old cells to age in reverse without turning into tumor cells, a brilliant graduate student named Wencheng Lu came into my office to say he was close to quitting. As a final effort, he suggested he try leaving out the c-MYC gene that was likely the cause of the teratomas, and I encouraged him to do so. He delivered a viral package to mice, but this time with only three of the Yamanaka factors, then turned them on using doxycycline and waited for all the mice to get sick or die. But none of them did. They were totally fine, and after months of monitoring, no tumors arose either. It was a surprise to both of us, a great surprise. Instead of waiting for another year to see if the mice lived longer, Wencheng suggested he use a mouse's optic nerve as a way to test age reversal and rejuvenation. I was skeptical. "I'm not super optimistic this will work," I told him. "Optic nerves just don't regenerate unless you're a newborn." The intricate network of cells and fibers that transmit nervous signals across our bodies is divided into two parts, the peripheral system and the central system. We've known for a long time that peripheral nerves, like those in our arms and legs, can grow back, albeit very, very slowly. The nerves of the central nervous system, though, optic nerves and the nerves of the spinal cord, never grow back. Even though scientists who bucked convention, proposing novel therapies that could regenerate some aspect of the central system, have generally been circumspect about the potential for significant regrowth. Decades of work aimed at reversing glaucoma in the eye and spinal cord injury has had almost no positive momentum. "You've picked the hardest problem in biology to solve," I told Wencheng. "But," he replied, "if we could solve that problem."
There might have been 1,000 ways to measure the impact of age reversal in mice, but buoyed by his recent successes, he decided to go big or go home. I liked that. No one changes the world by not taking risks, I told him. Go test it. The images that came to me in a text message a few months later took my breath away, so much so that I needed to make sure that what I was seeing was real.